The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream, then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect. All are humble and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw. We're absolutely delighted to have Jeff DeGraff joining us. Jeff is an advisor to Fortune 500 companies, a top innovation speaker, a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, and a best-selling author. He is founder of Innovatrium, an innovation consulting firm focused on creating innovation culture, capability, and community. He's worked with clients such as Apple, Coca-Cola, Google, General Electric, among many others. And early in his career, he helped turn Domino's Pizza into one of the fastest growing companies in the world, where he became known as the Dean of Innovation. Jeff has written 9 books. His latest is The Creative Mindset, Mastering the 6 Skills That Empower Innovation. And he can be reached at jeffdegraff.com. Jeff, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Michael and Simon, thanks for having me on, guys.
So just to put things in context, what's your story? How did you get here?
Boy, if I knew that, it would be wonderful. No, I was, I'm Forrest Gump. You know, I was a total screw up. You know, I'm one of those guys that I was all everything wrestler. It's how I got to college. I got through college as a teamster, was not a good high school student because I'm, you know, ADD and I'm dyslexic and all the things that, you know, now everyone is kind of sort of pushed out on. And when I got to college, it was like this incredible moment of freedom where you start figuring out how you make sense of the world. You start learning your instrument. And I went through college like it's insane how fast I went through. So I went from being kind of the dumb kid to the, you know, the presidential scholar at 25, you know, that kid. And then I came to Ann Arbor, of all things, to work on a supercomputer to diagnose diseases to teach medical students how to diagnose diseases. Got there, hated it. Met a guy in a hippie bar who worked for a guy with a $20 million pizza company. And I said, this sounds like more fun. And I quit and did that. People stopped talking to me that knew me. I mean, you know, you can imagine just, you know, they thought I was, you know, going to be the boy wonder. And I had the most fun building Domino's Pizza. I worked for Tom Monahan, who was terrific to me. Sold the company to Mitt Romney in Bain Capital. Last thing I did. And said at 29, okay, I'm going to retire. That lasted about 2 weeks before I drove myself crazy because people like me don't do well sitting around. And a fellow came to write a book about me, about what I'd done, not about me, but about my work. And I thought he was really cool. His name was Robert Quinn. He just retired, the famous business school professor. And he said, "You want to teach MBAs?" And I said, "No, they're dull, drab, and awful. You can hear them think." And he said, "That's why we want you." So that was 30 years ago at Michigan. And, you know, I built this innovation lab originally. Remember, this is the innovation was built, you know, a long time ago, well before WeWork and the D school and all that. And I built it because I felt like the only way you learn to be an innovator is the same way I learned. See one, do one, teach one. You know, you build stuff, you know, most of it doesn't work. You figure out, you know, how can you make it work? And you get people around you who are just way smarter and cooler than you are. And that's what I did. And, you know, it really has been luck. It's just been, you know, that pizza company could have been the local pizza company. And the student that I had who created the software company didn't have to be the founder of Google. It could have been somebody who was just starting a silly software. So I do think there's an element to this that's just dumb luck. But I do think there's one thing that I think you have to be is very curious and energetic, because if you're curious and energetic and keep at things, you know, you turn over enough rocks, you know, poke your head into enough things, you eventually some things start to make sense.
So Jeff, talk about that a little bit. I mean, you know, what we see in the world today is, you know, there's been so much chaos in the past year, the past 4 or 5 years, and you know, in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different forms. But all along, you know, there are some people who sort of figure things out, and some who kind of don't, that tend to struggle more or longer or never really figure things out. Is there a difference kind of between those two types of people or those two types of organizations, the ones that figure things out and the ones that tend to struggle?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'll give you a personal, and then we'll talk about, I think, the most salient example of the 21st century. You know, you meet people when COVID happened, who wrote their next book or built their next company or finished the basement or whatever. And then you met people who, you know, went to a corner and watched, you know, binge watch a program for a year. I think one is the former is being pulled towards something. They have a magnetic North Star, a sense of destiny, and they use their time to do that. And they're really irrepressible, and they would be doing this anyway. They've done this their whole life. And then there are others who are in a reactive position, who are waiting for things to become normative again, which of course they never will. And my favorite example of this is watching the two responses to COVID. And it's no different on this side of the water than it is in England as well. You look at the numbers, they're very similar. You look at what our governments did. They went to planning, processes, and penalties. Complete failure. Did not take into account how people are, didn't handle sort of the mechanisms of human behavior, human condition. Then I want you to look at the 595 shots on goal that were created basically in these two countries, right? Maybe a couple others that went into phase one trials in this country for a COVID vaccine. 116 made it through phase one, 54 through phase two, 9 through phase three, 3 in the bucket here, another one in the UK, right? So the notion is, what looks like chaos, you know, energy, just pure creative energy, has taken the cycle time for a new vaccine from 10 years to 10 months, right? Now, watch governments around the world try and put the genie back in the bottle. Good luck, right? Watch universities that have now gone to Zoom and Teams and everything else. Watch them try and see if everything can be back in class and get their price again. This is over. That's over. And there's some of us who know that's over and are playing for the next round, and some of us who are going to try and play for the last round. And I mean, that's the difference. The difference is, are you afraid of the future, right? Or are you enamored with the future? Either way, you're going there. So either that or it's over. Time to call it a day.
But Jeff, just on that, and totally agree with what you say, and the vaccines, you know, are looking to be developed around the world. But just in context there, though, and I'd like your opinion here, there was a single goal, you know, and I'm sure when you talk innovation and ideas, there's a vision, and then there's a whole load of buckets, and you're kind of throwing around buckets and going through levels of iteration. Is there, notwithstanding it's been a remarkable achievement, but is there something unique here? And
yes,
you know, to your point about taking that forward and the genie won't go back in the bottle, is there, you know, how does that become real for the future? You know, based on your learning, is there better ways to do innovation at that front end, et cetera, et cetera?
It's a great question, Simon. There's kind of two parts to the answer. The first part is, there are different cultures for innovation. And American culture in particular is event-driven culture. We're terrible at policy. We're the worst planning culture on the planet. I mean, and this is why when you look at things like, you know, gun control or, you know, you pick it, and we're not good at it. But when something happens, it's a crisis. This is kind of our culture is what I call the compete culture or market culture, right? And we can talk about the history of that. And there's a reason that we're event-driven, both good and bad. Look at how our stock exchange works, right? But the second thing you should know is that the reason that innovation happens in a crisis is the risk of trying something radical and the reward of staying where you're at is reversed. And the same is true, you know, it's true whether you're trying to quit drinking or you're pricing an option or you're, you know, your Apple in 1997, you're below $5 a share and the Wall Street Journal says you're going bankrupt. When that happens, you're going to try stuff. Now, the other side is, of course, our friends at Tesla. When you're on a roll, the risk of trying something radical, the reward of staying where you're at, it's reversed. So innovation right off the bat, if your listeners think about a bell curve, it does not happen in the middle. It happens at the edges and it moves from the outside in. It's a pincer maneuver. And the same is true for people. You know, you'll look at somebody who's got a ton of potential and at 55, they'll go through a divorce and all of a sudden you'll see it. But you didn't see it for years because they were happy, right? They didn't really have a need to do it. So that's always going to be the issue with why events like this are galvanizing. And it really is true that necessity is indeed the mother of invention. If you don't believe that, you should see my bird feeder outside my house and the squirrels who are like, you know, ninjas and they're geniuses in the winter because otherwise they don't eat. It doesn't matter what I do with my 4-pound brain to try and stop them.
So it, along those lines then, Jeff, I mean, you know, I'm thinking about sort of that intersection of, you know, creativity, innovation, whatever you want to call it. I mean, given what you just said, is that either a teachable thing or is it a learnable thing, whether that's individually or organizationally?
Yeah, the answer is yes and yes and yes. So the reason I built the Innovatrium was because the way I learned to innovate was a see one, do one, teach one way of doing it. It's the same thing they would use if you were learning Hari design in Japan, if you were learning Knoll School design, if you were part of the Edinburgh Enlightenment, and you were learning, you know, to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, the notion is it's teachable in as much as you can model or demonstrate. And this is where I've been insanely lucky in my career. I was Rudolf Arnheim's last graduate student. If you know anything about design thinking or creativity, you know, he's the last of the great Germans that, you know, Max Wertheimer's guys. Kurt Lewin was the other one, right? Bob Quinn, C.K. Prahlad. I got to be around people who are just way better than me. That's the truth of the matter. The second thing about learning, you learn by accelerating the failure cycle, not by avoiding it. So think about it, whether you're 8 or 80, you're trying to learn a new foreign language or an instrument, you're going through the failure cycle. You can either go slow. You know, my grandfather was Hungarian. If I really want to learn Hungarian, I could put a bunch of tapes on or go to some course, or I can go move to Budapest for 6 weeks and I guarantee I'll learn some Hungarian. Right. So the notion is, you know, you can accelerate the failure cycle. And this is what the whole idea now about minimal viable product and sprints and all this is about. It's really an old, old idea. I'm glad that people are bringing it back and are making it famous, but those of us who build things know this is how you do it. And then the final part about what can be taught. Look, we all are creative. It's part of our apparatus for being assimilating and accommodating information. It's part of the way your brain works. It's what's called cognitive mobility. Your brain has the ability to do that. Or everyone is kind of in full possession of their brain, right? The problem, though, is that we don't all have the same level of ability. And you learn that when you're in the eighth grade and, you know, your science partner was Einstein, you know, or in the ninth grade when you're on your basketball team was Michael Jordan, or in 10th grade in music class, Mozart sat next to you. I mean, what you learn is that not everybody got the same amount of everything, even though, you know, even though we're all creative, we're not all creative in the same way or to the same magnitude. And that's just the reality of it.
So, Jeff, how do you then, you know, we think that people have different levels of creativity and people are also different. Yeah, there's the introvert and there's the extrovert. And I'm guessing you're going to say, or potentially you're going to say, there's as much creativity in both, potentially. How do you extract that? You know, And we're thinking about this podcast and leaders and people who are listening to this. How do you get the best out of, I guess, those that are not forthcoming and those that are too gushing and forthcoming?
Yeah, there's two sides to this. It's a great question, Simon. First of all, pay attention to what people do under duress. It'll tell you whether they're right-handed or left-handed. So I have this model. A lot of people know it as the competing values framework of the innovation genome. You see it everywhere. But the, what they miss about the model is what I call the negative zone, what people do when they're stressed out. So if somebody immediately moves to a process, they're probably in the control quadrant. If they move to some kind of a radical, slippery vision, they're probably in the create quadrant. If they move to eliminate everything in their life except for a few goals, they're probably in the compete quadrant. And if, in fact, they start, you know, enlisting their friends and they really are relying on their values, they're probably in the collaborate quadrant. So first of all, we don't all do things the same way. And it's not just introvert, extrovert. We seek different forms of value and they're not style issues. God bless Myers-Briggs. I did when I was young for some validation studies for Isabel Briggs Myers. Her acts are actually named. It's a mother-daughter team. And they happen to be from the city I'm in, Ann Arbor, right? So when I was really young, I did some of those studies and I think it's terrific. But I think there's a challenge with that, which is what outcome do we seek? So it's not just about what you are. It's what's the situation that you're in, situational value that you're producing. And it also is very culturally defined. So for example, if I am in Japan, I'm not going to do brainstorming the way I would do it in America. Americans are noisy, pushy, aggressive. It's our culture. Think about how we got here. I mean, you know, we weren't exactly the refined group, if you know what I mean. Our culture has only become more like that, right? We're very event-driven. But if you go to Japan, there's brainstorming might be something like a Crawford slip method, where everybody quietly writes and builds on someone else's idea. The big thing when you've got an introvert is you always have to listen in the room for what's not being said and who's not saying it. And you need to pull them out. And you need to do it in a really safe way. So I'm very tender with introverts. And you need to give them a long time, because the big thing is, it's not that introverts don't want to talk to people. It's introverts have deep relationships with fewer people, right? They're more intimate. So the notion is you have to let that out and give them maybe smaller group time, coaching time, call them out, paraphrase time. And the same is true when somebody becomes belligerent, you know, or overly effusive, whatever you want to call it. You have to say, that's great. Point to someone else in the room and ask a question, because what a question does is it changes the angle or the vector of the discussion. Yeah. Right. And these kind, there's a million of these. I mean, I'm giving you two, there's probably 80. But the notion is, this comes with the art of learning to do this. And great teams are diverse teams, because this is the part that I think most people don't get. And I hope your listeners really understand what I'm going to say here. Great teams have trust and respect for each other, but they have constructive conflict. They have conflict about ideas. Now, there's kind of two parts to this. We want to avoid the kind of ad hominem arguments that people make, and they make them all the time right now on social media. It's really discouraging. We've micro-segmented people. That's half the problem. It's echo chamber. We only hear people who think the same crap we think, you know, confirmation bias. And so we have a tendency to demonize people who aren't like us, which is a shame, particularly in a heterogeneous society like we have. And you do, and particularly in London, not so much as you move out, but particularly in London. And I think the other side of that, though, is that all ideas, if they're respectful, are in play. And the reason is, the death of innovation is not conflict. It's apathy and compromise. Innovation is created by taking ideas and getting you a hybrid, a better way, a new way. And, you know, I love reading books about, you know, how Enigma was solved by the English and how that worked. And, you know, it's not just the English, the Polish are there, and, you know, there's a lot of different groups there, just like how things are invented here, just like how COVID, you know, it's easy to say that 595 shots on goal were in the United States. But if you start looking at the United States, the history of immigration is the history of innovation. We had 6 Nobel laureates this year. Not a single one was born here. Right. So the notion is, when you look at the 20 to 25 places in this country, and probably the same, Simon, in England, or the UK in general, when you look at them, what you're going to notice is these 20 to 25 places are far more diverse in their adjacent areas. And it's not just sort of political correctness, although there is a part to that, right? We want to honor other people and be respectful of that. But the notion is, people come from different places, have different ideas. And there is some polite and within decorum pushing and shoving. So I go back to my Domino's years. Oh, geez, there's some years. I go back to when I was advisor to Steve Jobs in my Apple years, right? The whole idea of what was AppleNet, which became Connect, which became iTunes. You know, those days are not, they're not cakewalks. There's a lot of, there's a lot of challenges. And, but in the right spirit, in the notion of we're getting to the next place, we're going to the moon. And this comes back to your point, Simon. If there's no shared vision, then this conflict simply becomes conflict. You have to be being pulled with a sense of destiny towards something.
So in that sense then, Jeff, I mean, it sounds like that comes down to leadership too, right? Of,
Having
the clarity of a common goal and you know, a shared sense of where people want to go.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the right person to talk about leadership from the standpoint, I write a lot about it, from the standpoint of I've never felt I was a good leader. And I still don't. I think we all lead in different ways. The way I lead, it's very funny. I remember I read all the books and people talking about Steve Jobs. I was on one of his advisor groups. I was very young, called AIS, Applied Integrated Systems, which is before the internet. There's no internet.
Yeah.
And what struck me about him was he led through vision, which I think is what I do. I'm seeing something. It's not really clear. I think we're going in this direction. I think we're going to build something here, but I'm not sure. So in my form of leadership, there's a lot of, you know, it's not just first star on the right. It's, I don't know if we can get there, but let's try it. Right. Once more an inch of the breach. Right? but it seems to me that creativity clusters, as they call them, are often emergent, and they often platoon leaders in and out. So there's a different leader for what stage you're in. It takes a different type of a leader. So the type of a leader in these 595 clusters that started to come up with stuff, I imagine it's like any startup, you know, it's a hydra with a lot of different heads, right? And as it moves to putting vaccines in arms, and what was missing, of course, was somebody to be in charge of that. So I think it does come down to leadership, but I think when we think of leadership in kind of the follow me boys thing, it's not that kind of leadership, at least typically not.
Jeff, you talked earlier about curiosity and energy has helped you, and you talk about luck. You know, I'm sure the listeners and Mike and I agree that it's also fortune, and you make your fortunes. So just help us understand a little bit more about how you built, you know, an amazing brand at Domino's Pizzas. And I'm curious as to what you did to get the best stuff done there. And also what you're learning from there, because I'm guessing too, you would agree as you go through your career, and this podcast is all about what I wish I knew. You've learned stuff and you've taken that on board.
Yeah. The biggest thing that I've learned is I thought early on that it was all about strategy. What I learned at Domino's, it was all about talent and it was all about culture and things that were hard to get your hand around. I believed two things happened at Domino's that were stunning to me. One, I worked for a man who saw in me something I didn't see in me. And he gave me an enormous amount of freedom and responsibility very early on. I'm 25 when I become on the executive team, right? I'm a very young man. And what I liked about him is he would pull me aside and he would say, I've got a problem. I don't know how to solve it. Will you solve it? Will you help me solve it? It was great. Because I was sort of the side guy. I didn't run things. I built things. And so one of the first things I got to do, I remember this vividly, was the Pope came to America. Tom Monnet's very, very traditional Catholic. I'm a Catholic, but he's more Catholic than I am. I'll put it that way. And he said, I'd like to see, now this is when he doesn't even have a lot of money. I want to see if we can do some things to cover this in a way. So he was very involved, and there's some Catholic networks that were emerging in cable, right? So this is very early on. And so he said, can you help me with this? So I called around and I found that AT&T had a truck that was used for transmitting telephone lines. And you start looking into, can I transmit video on this? And can I put it on a truck? Can I drive around the country? And how do I find this? You know, you start looking into this. You call friends, you hire people who are really young, because the older people told you couldn't do it. So I hired a couple of people who really had no real schooling. And we built this, we covered them. And then we built a television network for the local sports team here, the Detroit Tigers, a baseball team. We did this kind of thing like there's a dozen of these, right? So what I learned was somebody who has trust in you, who gave me a lot of room. And he said, I believe in you as a person, right? But it wasn't like total freedom. It was like I had to fix things. I had to deliver. And I did. There's a wild thing I did. If we have time, I'll tell you about it. But and then I started doing that with people when I hired them. And I had some really sad learnings, which is there are people who are really capable, but they, for some reason, don't have a fire in the belly. They don't want to get to the next place. And I, being very honest with your listeners, I never know why. There's a million reasons why, right? A million reasons why things don't work. And then there are people who I had serious doubts were capable of doing things who turned out to be amazing. I had a right-hand person who went on to be one of the key people at Apple. She was a speech teacher, right? I would have never thought that. So I think what I really learned was hire for talent and culture. I think culture matters too, a lot. We don't get ahead individually. We get ahead as teams. So the minute that the team that built Domino's left Domino's, people forget Domino's went through 15 years in the desert, had enormous problems. And I think it was because I think Bain Capital thought it was a model. It wasn't a model. It was a bunch of kids. Some, you know, they were older than me, but they weren't very old. And then what happened about a decade ago is they got on board with the talent thing and they really took off again. They started to understand the business again.
It's fascinating.
You know, along those lines, I mean, we talked a little bit about it, but when you think of things like innovation, you talked about necessity being the mother of invention and that kind of thing. Do you think that either organizationally or individually that a couple factors that hold us back are complacency or fear? Or what is it that, why not innovate?
Yeah, I think, yes, complacency and fear right at the top of the list. I think the other thing that really bothers me is arrogance. You know, I have to say, you know, I've been an advisor over the years at the Federal Reserve. And those guys who say, go big or go home. I love the fact that a lot of them went home. Just go home. We don't need you. This is not how it works. I think the greatest movie I've ever seen on innovation is Moneyball. You don't even have to understand American baseball. You just understand this guy can't win by playing the way everybody else plays. So he tries something radically different and people forget this part of the movie. He loses a lot and everybody wants to fire him. That's my life. That's me. Right. And then somehow it starts to work. And yes, you built it and whatever, but you're not exactly sure yet why it works. And then you win an insane amount and then you stop dabbling and you don't get through the playoffs. Right. And you got to keep dabbling. And that's kind of if you watch this and in a class and you sort of talk about what's going on in terms of what they're doing, that's the innovation process. And you're just trying to move. You're trying to create momentum. That's what Domino's was. Once we got momentum, it was stunning. You know, when we left, it was just watching people then saying, well, we're now here. And you're going, that's now we've lost momentum and trying to start it again. It's just too hard. Apple, you know, the two times at Apple, you know, that Apple, you know, the two periods of great, great growth. And this is what's called Schumpeter's Gale. It's actually the famous Eastern European economists, which innovation economics, you know, last 10 Nobel laureates, we've had six of them, right? The sort of on the behavioral economic side, the Schumpeter side. Remember when during his time, he was considered to be crazy, right? But people like now he's a hero. But, you know, back then he was like, you know, you got this goofy guy who was ended up at Harvard and, how, you know, he's crazy. But Schumpeter's Gale basically says that, you know, this is where that quote comes from. The seeds of our undoing are sown at the pinnacle of our success. I mean, you know, everybody talks about Milton Friedman. It's actually an old Schumpeter quote. And the point that he was making is when you're General Motors in 1950 and you have 63% of the world's car market, you know, you're invincible. But you scroll forward to 2009, drip, 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 you're bankrupt. Well, all of a sudden, General Motors comes out and goes, you know, in 2025, we're all going to be electric and we're going to really compete. Well, yeah, it's great. The question is, the Chinese are there. The question is, Toyota's there. You know, is that enough? Did they recover in time? I don't know. Speed and magnitude, how much and how fast? I don't know. Yeah. We'll have to see.
And Jeff, just, you know, innovation. And we talked this before we just set the interview up, how exciting it is for us, how exciting it is for many, many businesses and people. And sometimes in my career, it can be this kind of gravity pull for everybody in the company because it's a sexy new toy. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you, and what's your perspective on how should, you know, again, people listening of all different types of companies, businesses around the world and segments and sectors, how do you come to terms with, well, first of all, this kind of weighting of innovation in your work stream to getting stuff today done? And secondly, you know, how do you, what's your recommendation on how do you deploy that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's kind of three answers. Let me take them one at a time. First of all, I absolutely agree. I'm reading in between the lines what you're talking about. A lot of what goes on now is what I call innovation theater. It's just theater, right? People who've never built anything in their life, you know, they learned, they read a book, they went to a lab somewhere. Come on, really? You know, great innovators, the ones I grew up with were like Kelly Johnson, you know, the Skunk Works guy, but he built the P-38 and the U-2 and the Blackbird and the Caravelle. And, you know, and he wasn't this charming guy. He was kind of, you know, anything but. How about that? But he's a great innovator, right? Claude Shannon, you know, was also from up the road. He was, you know, very eccentric. I'll leave it at that. Well, the English, you kind of are familiar with that, right? So it's not a unique thing. But I would say three things. First of all, the everybody should innovate movement is a terrible idea because most of what you want to do in organizations maintain, right? There's two things. You want to deviate, right? Maintenance and deviance. Innovation is a form of positive deviance. And you only want to have some part of your organization pulling it forward. So I need you to think about this like a funnel or maybe even like a military excursion. So if you will forgive the military metaphor, right? The first people are going to be scouts, speculators, you know, Tom Clancy novels, people with a sidearm and binoculars and all those Graham Greene novels, you know, the English are great, it's just spies and, you know, they're all crawling around on all fours. And that's like my Innovatrium, that's, you know, think tanks, that's Silicon Valley, it's where I live in Ann Arbor, you know, it has all this venture capital per person, right? These, you know, Cambridge, what do you call it? Silicon Fair, whatever you call it over there, right? Mm-hmm. Same, that's that.
Yeah.
Right. And it's diverse and crazy. And, you know, 90% of that stuff isn't going to work. Then you need middling position innovators. People like to make business plans. They went to business school. They're focused. They say, stick to the knitting and we got to go fast. And, you know, they, you know, and then you got the other side of that, which are your collaborators who are making sure you get the community together, you make sales work. They take longer. The funnel's getting a little closer together here and a little less crazy, right? You're trying to get the right team and the right business plan on the floor. And this often takes far longer than people think it will. And this is often called the bottom of the bathtub or Death Valley, right? Things that you lose momentum, takes three times as long. And then in the end, you have to have the aft position innovators, which you have to manufacture the stupid thing. You know, you got to make 2 million of them and global distribution. So I've come back to the COVID example because this will make it clear to everybody. So you have the 595 shots on goal, and then you have the United States National Guard and all the pharmacies in this country that can get, you know, sticks in people's arms. The problem was there was no plan and there wasn't engaging in the community. The middle, what's called the middling pieces, were missing, right? So now we're going back and building the middling pieces. And what people are stunned at is now we're actually had a schedule. So now we're going fast. So the notion is there's an order to this, and there are different kinds of innovation depending on where you are in this movie, right? If you're at the beginning of the movie, it should be radical, high degree of, high failure rate. Middle of the movie, you should be focusing. You should be picking out the things that are really going to work, getting the right people and the right talent on board. End of the movie, this should be methodological processes, turnkey, bang, bang, bang. You know, so, you know, scouts, you know, the middle piece is we're either in diplomacy or we're trying to get a beachhead at the end. We're either building hospitals or it's heavy artillery, right? One or the other. Again, sorry for the metaphor, but I think it makes it clear. I mean, the object is just to illuminate this. I think that it requires a system, and where people fail is the handoffs. It's the handoffs, and you could see this in the way COVID was handled in this country. It's the handoffs that kill you. If you can't move between these types of innovation and these types of innovators, and if you don't have that range of innovators, you can't make this work.
So I wanted to ask about that, Jeff. I mean, there, you know, it's interesting. COVID is a pretty fascinating example because global society has seen an innovation process with everybody having a sort of a front row seat, right? You know, few people really understood what they were facing, but, you know, we've all sort of followed this innovation process, you know, beginning to end. If you think back, you think about brands, you think about companies, or even you think about innovation happening in organizations, whether it's governments or whatever, is there a common spot of failure? You talked about the handoffs, but the people that have failed in the past, is it generally they have bad ideas, or is it they didn't, you know, make the transition from idea to product or idea to process? Is there a common failure?
No. And it's no, I wish there was. Innovation is highly situationally specific. How you make an F-22 and how you make a fine dining restaurant is completely different. I would come back to kind of three things. One, innovation is all about timing. Did you get the timing right? And there's really very little theory for timing. You know, talk to any Nobel laureate in economics and they'll tell you this. Two, it really is about the handoffs that we talked about. Can it move from ideation? Is there enough money for it? Can it move to manufacturing? And think about all the organizations that got there first, but didn't have the money, but the organizations that had the manufacturing, but, you know, think about Tesla. I mean, think about, the EV1. I don't know if your listeners have ever thought about this, but General Motors developed a electronic vehicle in 1993, right? And the patents were all filed during the oil embargo in the early 70s, and the patents elapsed. They made the cars, they were successful, and they buried several hundred of them in the desert of California, right? And the patents all lapsed. And our friends at Tesla and other friends, that now becomes intellectual property that people can use, right? So here's somebody who had the wherewithal to do it, had the invention to do it, but did not want to stick with it because they thought it cannibalized some of their product. I did this with Hulu, right? Working on Hulu. For General Electric, which owned NBC Universal at the time, local television. You know, why did they get rid of Hulu? Well, because it began to cut into their rate card. So that's the handoffs matter. And the final thing, it's persistence. You know, so much of innovation is just, it's not throwing a punch, it's taking a punch. You just, if you think about it, this is what I talk about with all my friends who are in the innovation community, these really well-known innovators, we complain to each other about how much we're having the snot beat out of us, right? And that's kind of the currency of that. Sort of like, yeah. You know, sort of like going to the bar, talking to your bar friends about how, you know, somebody just, you know, kicking you all over the place on this. And because it's not glamorous like people think it is. It's not a glamorous occupation. You build because if you didn't build, you know, it's an obsession. You'd be drinking, you know, or doing something dangerous. I don't know. It's one of the few socially redeeming things. Think about it. You know, both of you, didn't you have people in your family who tinkered in the basement, in the kitchen, in the garage? Didn't you have somebody at a side hustle before where they called them side hustles, right? Yeah, wasn't that what made their life happy? It's one of the things I love about going to the pub in England. You know, everyone, if you're an innovation guy, everyone trots out. They all have something they're working on. And they're like, I have the direct line to Kleiner Perkins or something. They want to show me their thing, right? And I love that. I do. I love it. I'm like, you're alive. You're thinking. You're building. Okay, it's not your day job, but that's fine.
No, so no value true. Judgment then. The creative process is something that you feel like everybody should engage in.
Why else are we here? If we're not here to make our world, our community, ourselves better and new, why are we here? It's the why question. What are you for? Right? And it don't make it heroic. Maybe it's about, you know, you build a little better life for your kids. Maybe it's about that little room that used to be a closet is something that's a keepsake for you. I don't know. I just think we've lost perspective on that. We're creative beings. It's part of our gift. I'm not trying to be religious here, but my view of the world, this is part of, you know, God's gift. This is what you're supposed to be doing. You know, so, you know, you can't take the Jesuit out of the old Catholic, right? I think we get lost in these other things that are terrible distractions, you know, social media or games that don't really add to any of that. So my big thing is, you know, if you like games, build one. You know, if you like reading, write a book. Doesn't mean it gets published. Yeah. If you like music, go to the pub and play your instrument.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
The other thing, Jeff, and again, through your life and experience with major companies, and Mike and I, I've come across this too, where companies, you know, there's kind of an axis point of where the innovation and the development, you know, needs or requires a certain amount of, let's say, research insight, you know, qual or quanta, etc. What's your take on that? In, you know, what point again is the tipping point there? And I'm feeling, you know, the energy and the belief has to be a part of that. But I'm intrigued as to what you've learned along the journey.
Yeah, this is a lot of what we do at the Innovate Room is building these ecosystems for these huge companies and bigger than companies, governments and things like that. It's a really good question, Simon. There's kind of, think of it like a pyramid, and you can innovate anywhere on the pyramid, but really substantive innovations like a vaccine start at the bottom of the pyramid with basically discovery, bench engineers. It's boring. It's to me, when people talk about innovations of the year, these magazines always miss it because the best ones are like material science and, you know, and it's, you know, figuring out zero ohms, you know, how to do something at zero ohms, those kind of things. The next level is what I call technology transfer, right? So it goes from a secret of nature to a thingness. It becomes a molecule, becomes an alloy, right? And then the final part is it's an application or it's a product. So the pyramid, you know, all the things that we write about, I'm talking to you on an iPhone, one of those new iPhones. And what's interesting to me is how much of this phone has to do with the material, you know, that the glass is made a certain way so it doesn't break. And the ability for, you know, the microchip to work in a certain way has a lot to do with how that alloy can be printed at that, you know, at that molecular level and so on and so forth. So that the gadget is just kind of the final piece to that. So I think real innovations have these three elements. They almost always have an academic element. And incidentally, this is one of the great gifts that the English really bequeathed to the Americans, which was the university system, you know, whether it's Cambridge or Oxford or Imperial or London, you know, a million of these things, and us too, the whole idea that you put real money into that, which comes from the Industrial Revolution, really, and what the English did. I think the second, and our institutes, and the second thing that I think you need to have is incredibly forgiving tax laws and liquid capital. We could do much better but we're pretty good for a large country. I think Israel does a much better job. There's a weirder version that's vertically integrated. Think about Singapore and what goes on with Temasek on the Science Board and the National University, right? And then I think the final piece is you have to have a customer that is an ongoing customer. And this will be very controversial to your listeners. I think this is one of the roles the military serves, right? That has to have somebody who's constantly trying to be in front. You have to have a pace setter, right? And you can do a better or worse job with it. And I think, and I'm not trying to make this guy, I'm not trying to describe sort of militarization. I'm just saying that you have to have an engine that's pulling you forward on a regular basis. That's saying, well, you know, we've got to get to the next place. And I guess it could be space or something else. I guess it could be, right? But there's got to be something that drives that. And I think if you have those three elements together, you start to build an ecosystem. But they all have to have a line of sight to each other. So the problem we have, as you well know, in the academic community, there's a lot of people who do great research, but haven't really spent any time in the real world. You have a lot of people in the real world who have a lot of ideas, but they're not based on, you know, scientific reality or rigor. You know, you have a lot of people who are, you know, in the military world who maybe don't have a line of sight to the other two. So the issue is when you build these ecosystems, trying to get them to see each other. I shouldn't just say military, government too. I should have said that as well.
So Jeff, tell us a little bit about creativizing. You know, you've taken it, I think, on board to do large scale instruction about creativity. What's your angle on that?
I grew up in a hut house. With no money. I got to college because I was an athlete and I got a union job, right? As a Teamster. For those listeners who are in England, the Teamsters are not exactly the nicest people you've ever met. I'll leave it at that, right? They were nice to me. They were good to me. They drive trucks. They drive trucks and load trucks. That's what they, you know, in this country. What I saw and what I continue to see in underserved neighborhoods are the most creative people I've ever seen in my life. People who make almost no money and they actually have a decent life, right? They could be better and money would improve it. But I've talked about this in the book, The Creative Mindset. I remember going up north when I'm a young boy, and it doesn't occur to you that your parents don't have any money. So we're driving in an old Dodge. We're up north, and Michigan has two peninsulas. It has it's divided by the water. You know, 20% of all the world's surface fresh water is around the state of Michigan, Scott. You know, it's all water, the mitten in the northern part, right? It's all water. So we're way in the northern part by Canada. And it becomes very clear that the clutch has burned out on our old Dodge. And then watching my dad sort of negotiate, you know, it was amazing, a horse trader, negotiate, I'll spend a day at your service garage changing, you know, swapping out transmissions or something. You're going to give me these parts. And, it was amazing. We were all playing and swimming in Lake Superior, having a great time. My dad's doing all this stuff. And everywhere we go on the way down, there was another kind of deal. And eventually, you know, in a day or two, you're home. And you realize late years later, what an amazing amount of creativity had to go into how am I going to get home? How am I going to get all, you know, five kids? How am I going to get everybody home? And I see this all the time in neighborhoods. So creativizing is simply taking the ordinary, adding creativity to it to make it extraordinary. That's all it is. And I love this term. I coined the term, but I love the term because it really imbues the democratization of creativity and innovation. If there is one thing that was my mission, my sole belief, is the democratization of creativity and innovation, not just for Americans or the English, for everybody. I think that's how you liberate people. That's how people, so I'm a believer in kind of that old system, but I'm a believer in that we have to work at that. We have to create provision for that. You know, we have to cherish that's how we get to the next place.
Wow. Are you excited with, you know, we talk about the world is getting flatter and connection stronger. Are you excited by that? You know, the fact that more countries, more people around the world are going to provide more real innovation. So in other words, they can do it in their own backyard, but it's going to become global.
Yes. And I think what happens at the end of every epoch is the old guard tries to strangle the new. The worst strategy for innovation is to try and put the new into the old. Right, the old either fits into the new or it fades away. That is the inevitable finger of history. That is the arc that is, and it's irrefutable. So the fact that we're returning to nationalism and everybody's going, we're going back to nationalism, guys, what, for a decade, then it's over. Think about even the pandemic. You know, you solve it here. If it's not solved every place else, it's not over. Right? There's nothing about these arbitrary boundaries that, you know, if the environment collapses, it's not about nation states, guys. It's about we live here. And I'm not trying to make a moral argument. I'm trying to make a very practical, fungible argument here, saying if, in fact, you look at where things are going to get solved, they cannot be solved in the nation state way. And who has replaced the nation state has been multinational corporations. Yeah. Right. So the notion is, I think that that's kind of also a step. I don't think that sticks around either. If you look at, there's an alarming trend. There was about 20,000 companies traded publicly around 1990. There's less than four today. Private equity, the rich get richer. Right. This is what's happening. And you're seeing the tension because either that tension, at some point that tension breaks. You're seeing people in the streets in all of our countries. Right. That tension breaks. I'm old enough to remember the 60s. You know, that tension will break somehow. And either people will figure out a hybrid, which I hope they do. I'm kind of fond of the old system. I'm product of it. You know, I'd like to see the version 2 or version 12 or whatever version we're on. Or we'll break and we'll see something much more radical. Yeah. And we know this. These are the lessons of history. Right. So to me, yes, I'm delighted that, you know, other countries are developing technologies. I think we're also going through the natural piece of, I'm not delighted that, you know, we have some of the same old issues about what are we going to do with it and how am I going to ruin you? And, you know, but I think that's just inevitable. I don't approve it. You know, I'm pretty clear on where I'm at on that. But I like the fact that people can pull themselves up, in their own way. For example, I love what's happening in some countries in Africa. I love what's happening in Ghana, you know, absolutely stunning parts of Tanzania, right? You're looking at this and going, wow, you know, I've lived a long life, but going, wow, that is impressive.
So last question, Jeff, you know, and this maybe ties into what you just said. What about the world today gives you optimism in terms of, you know, innovation, not just in product, but across culture and government and that kind of thing? Are there signs that give you optimism about what's to come?
Yeah, I think what continues to make me frustrated is the micro segmenting of social media has created extremities on the left and the right. And forget left and right. Those aren't even the right terms. They're the wrong terms. But there are groups that have antithetical ideas. It's almost like one of Newton's laws of thermodynamics, you know, the equal and opposite reaction. What I'm impressed with is the move to the middle. And the move to the middle didn't just make everything in the middle. Now we're starting to see some of those genuine concerns actually moving, and not just in this country, in a lot of countries. We're seeing sort of like after the drinking, we're seeing kind of the move to, okay, we have to make this work, right? And I think the silent middle is beginning to move. And I think they're beginning to incorporate some of these new ideas, albeit not at the magnitude we want yet. But I have to say, I actually like this. I don't think you bet it all at once. I think you play money ball. You say, can we fix the schools in this district? And we'll try it in 5 districts. And if one of them works, then maybe that's the model we go with. And maybe we try and fix the schools. But I'm starting to see forward momentum as opposed to reactive momentum. Now, don't get me wrong. We've had some pretty traumatizing things at the beginning of this year in this country, some pretty doggone traumatizing things. But I think it's, I'm very optimistic, and this is not a political statement. I'm very optimistic that that people who are more pragmatic are beginning to say, how do we actually make this work? And I think it's just like families. You know, families, I think, are coming out of COVID and saying, how do we make our family work? And I see this as a very positive sign. And yes, we're going to continue to have at the edges stuff, but the edges are getting smaller and they seem to be less potent.
Wow. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for your time. This has been a fascinating conversation, and really admire your point about the democratization of creativity and, you know, the steps in the innovation process that apply to big organizations and small and even individually. So I know that our listeners will take a lot from this conversation. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Michael. And thank you, Simon. I appreciate it. It was a terrific being on.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.